Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news wrap-up from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the Utah Department of Transportation says that it prefers a gondola for Little Cottonwood Canyon, eventually. Brigham Young University is still investigating the racist slurs yelled at a Duke volleyball player last week after video footage appeared to clear the man originally blamed. We'll get a preview of the University of Utah football season ahead of Game 1 at the Swamp. And I think that unavoidably we will have to talk about the fact that the Utah Jazz are trading Donovan Mitchell to the Cleveland Cavaliers as well. Joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Jacob Scholl. And good morning, Jacob. Thanks for being here.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Also here in studio is Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks, as always, for being here, Robert.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have your microphone on. Let's try that again.
I'm still happy to be here,
okay,
Roger.
I'm glad you're here. And on the Zoom this morning, we've got Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. And welcome to you, Courtney. Good morning.
Good morning, Roger.
A little bit later in the show, we will also hear from Tribune athletics reporter Josh Newman, all the way from Gainesville, Florida. Listeners, you can join this conversation, if you'd like, by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. The handle is at KCPW, and we will try to respond here live on air. Some sports coverage coming up just ahead, but let's start with news that is at the intersection of transportation, environment, tourism, and outdoor recreation. Jacob Scholl, the Utah Department of Transportation, as I said, has endorsed the idea of putting a gondola up Little Cottonwood Canyon as a transportation solution, I guess, for especially wintertime congestion. What does UDOT say about why they made this decision, or why this was their decision? What was their sort of rationale?
Yeah, so this sort of thing is just a bunch of years in the works, and really the UDOT just took all of the different factors, whether that's environmental concerns or how much money it's going to cost. They just rolled all that together, and in their estimation, this was just the preferred solution, I guess, for them.
I have read people saying that this is a decision that's not necessarily set in stone. I know that there's a public comment period launching today, but is UDOT's decision set in stone or is it not set in stone? Do we know?
Well, so not really set in stone. So essentially going forward, like you said, yeah, there is a 45-day comment period that opened today that will run until, I believe, October 17th. But people are encouraged to just leave their comments, and so UDOT has as much public input as possible. So really going forward, it's going to come down to a lot of different things, mostly the Utah State Legislature. This is essentially something that would cost the state easily over $500 million. Yeah, UDOT can't unilaterally do that kind of thing without some sort of, increased budget. They have to obviously pay for the gondola, but they also have to pay for the land where all of the towers would go, where the base station would go near the mouth of Little Cottonwood Canyon. So it's gonna take some time. This is not the kind of thing that's gonna happen overnight, obviously.
So I guess to say set in stone, more hurdles to clear before they get there, including funding it by the legislature.
Yeah, that's a safe assumption.
In the meantime, they're gonna try to tweak things to make the canyon less congested, enhanced bus service, which is what people have been saying is the simple fix for quite some time, right? What's the plan there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much just that, adding additional bus services. They've also floated the possibility of putting in additional mobility hubs, which, is basically just going to kind of speed up the flow of traffic and that sort of thing. There are steps that they're taking more in the short term, with the hopes of, building it up to a gondola long term.
Long term could be years ahead.
Could be, yeah.
How quickly are these enhanced bus services and you said mobility hubs? How quickly will they be put into place?
That's another good question. That's not totally clear. I think that's another thing that UDOT would have to set in motion kind of sooner rather than later. But these are just kind of things that they want to do in the short term rather than, just wait a couple of years for a gondola to be put up.
A couple of people quoted in your story, Roger Bork, mayor of the town of Alta, Carl Fisher with the conservation group Save Our Canyons. They sounded kind of optimistic. Yeah, not about the gondola, but about these, about what's going to happen about this enhanced bus service, about these simple fixes, because it could serve as a model and maybe thereby prevent the gondola from happening. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my impression was that they seemed optimistic about this. Like you said, this is going to be short-term solutions, and yeah, this is the kind of stuff that they were pushing for initially. Expanded bus services, giving the public every incentive possible to use public transit, so a gondola presumably wouldn't have to go up. But I think that's a fair categorization.
Would you mind explaining there? I mean, you have Salt Lake County Mayor Jenny Wilson, who is in this camp.
Mm-hmm.
But can you? Would you mind kind of explaining their opposition to the gondola? What is it that they say? Why are they opposed to it? I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a couple different things. First off, gondola would, with the current plans of UDOT, essentially use taxpayer money to deliver people directly to Snowbird and Alta, which obviously are private businesses. So you have a good bit of people who are opposed to it on that front, but you also have a lot of people that are just opposed to the very idea of a gondola going down Little Cottonwood Canyon. Some of the towers would be over 200 feet tall, would obstruct views, and then also the fact that you can't really backtrack when you put that kind of thing up. When you have 200-foot gondola towers going throughout the canyon, you can't really walk that back and just say, oh no, well now we'll expand the roadway or expand bus services, that kind of thing. It's a very definite solution.
Yeah. Right, and then I guess another complaint that they made was that it's sort of specific to the ski resorts. The resorts themselves
mm-hmm.
are they are proponents of this, right?
Yeah, they've been proponents for the gondola for a while now. When UDOT narrowed down the two possibilities to expanding the roadway for bus dedicated lanes or the gondola. Both of the ski resorts, Alta and Snowbird, were very much in favor of the gondola at that point.
And you wrote, in fact, that I can't remember which of the resorts, but one of them acquired land near to where the base of this gondola will go, and they did that quite recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it would have been last fall. So actually, a year from now, it would have been last September.
Mm-hmm.
But Snowbird purchased two plots of land, just a little under 5 acres, but. Essentially, that land is exactly where the gondola base station would be located. They tried to do it as quietly as possible. And when I was talking to the general manager and president of Snowbird, Dave Fields, essentially he was saying that Snowbird wanted to make that purchase to ensure the gondola was a viable option. If that plot of land was gone, that's essentially a route that UDOT would not be able to take if they wanted to pick, the gondola option.
Hmm. There was also, I just to kind of clarify this, because I remember people had questions about who owned maybe that specific plot of land before, and
mm-hmm.
was it wrapped up in a kind of, was a former legislator who owned that or a lawmaker who owned that land?
Yeah, so the entity that owned that before was a company called CW Management Corp. And that was founded by two people. One is Chris McCandless, who is the person who primarily runs the business now. He's been a developer for a bunch of years, and he also used to be a city council member for the city of Sandy. And then the other person who established that company was Wayne Niederhauser, who was a long time senator in Utah, was a president of the Utah Senate for a good bit of time, and most recently he is now in charge of addressing homelessness
right.
across the state for the governor's office.
Right, and he sort of divested himself of this property, maybe because of the perceived conflict.
Well, and he told me when he went back into public service, essentially, he kind of, again, this is just what he told me, but when he did that, he kind of is taking more of a hands-off approach with CW Management. And, at least he told me that, he has not really been a part of the business since then.
There's been a bit of a PR blitz in favor of the gondola,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering if you, this actually may not be clear, but I'm wondering if you can tell us kind of who is behind the gondola advocating. Who are the forces working behind the scenes to push the proposal and, Yeah, and I guess, yeah, and maybe why are they doing it is the second part of that question, but you might not be able to answer that.
Sure. So the group really advocating for the gondola is a group called Gondola Works, which, you know, it's pretty straightforward with the name, but, you know, obviously they support the construction of a gondola. They think that's the best solution for the canyon. And, you know, that this one of the stories I actually did last week, but essentially some of the groups behind that are namely Snowbird. You know, this was a group that was started in recent years when the gondola became more of an option for UDOT. And yeah, they've been, you know, very public facing with social media campaigns, different ad campaigns through different media. But yeah, it's, you know, it's Snowbird, it's Alta, it is a couple other, you know, entities kind of around Salt Lake City. But yeah, they've been pushing for the gondola ever since.
We've seen sort of flashy videos and presentations and campaigns splashed across social media, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that's who's paying for it. The time frame on all of this, and you said $500 million if the legislature funds it. How long would it take to make a gondola if they do that? And how long would temporary solutions be in place, or maybe not temporary? I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's really all up in the air right now, because you know, like you said, this ultimately will have to go to the legislature. So it's just going to come down to, you know, how quickly they would like to address this. You know, for all I know, they could introduce a bill on the first day of legislature and pass everything through, and then, you know, by next summer they could be doing construction. But, you know, I don't know that for sure. It's really all just up in the air, and it's going to take some time.
I'll come back to you on the public comments question. Mm-hmm. Robert Gerke, let's bring you into the conversation, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist. Where do you fall on this? I know you wrote a column on this topic this week about, I think, kind of about that temporary solution. But what's your stance on the gondola?
Well, I mean, I think that initially I was pretty agnostic about it. I mean, because neither of these options was very good, and the do-nothing approach wasn't really sustainable. We had cars lining up at the mouth of Little Cottonwood Canyon for a quarter mile every Saturday, Sunday during the winter, because people were trying to get up there and ski, and it created conflicts with other users of the canyon. And so doing nothing seemed like a bad option to me. But and you know, widening the road is pretty disruptive to the entire canyon. You know, I kind of liked that idea in concept a little bit more, but they were going to add two lanes. That's a pretty big footprint. And so, you know, gondola seemed like it was viable. But I think, you know, over time, I've kind of soured on the gondola because I think that, as Jacob noted, it does deliver people from the mouth of the canyon to the ski resorts and doesn't do anything for anybody who does anything between those two points. Or really above those two points. I mean, if you're trying to get to Albion, I guess you can go to Alta and then, like, you know, hike up from there. But it really only serves those two ski resorts, and it's a big investment. It's corporate welfare, is what it is. And I know that the owners of the ski resorts sort of bristle when people say that, but it's going to be a roughly $600 million taxpayer investment to move people to their business. And I think any business owner is going to love to have that. You know, I'm sure if you have a restaurant, you would love to have $600 million spent to get people to your front door. But that's not the way we use taxpayer money typically. And I think the $600 million is pretty conservative, frankly. I mean, it's we've seen this, the cost of this project go up and up and up over time. And if it doesn't cost $1 billion when it's all said and done, I think I would be very, very surprised. So I think it is important that we do, as Mayor Wilson said, and as Jacob alluded to, these interim steps. And UDOT has said they're going to do some of these interim steps. And I think it's important that we do those and do those, you know, not in a sort of half-baked manner. You know, maybe we can put off the gondola for a few years if we are able to manage traffic between now and then in some meaningful way. You got to remember, we're talking about congested days in the canyon, although I will say the canyon has been getting more congested in the spring and summer months as well. Mm. But basically, we're only talking about weekends during ski season from December to March, April.
Depending.
Yeah, depending on, and who knows in 20 years if there's going to be a ski season. You know, the projections are that by the end of the century, that the temperatures will increase between 4 and 11 degrees at the ski resorts. And
a lot more precipitation with rain.
And that's going to make it, yeah, I mean, you're going to, it's going to, and it makes it hard to make snow, too. So it's, you know, so there's some real questions hanging over the industry in general. But, I mean, that's not driving the decision. What's driving the decision is money and power and politics. So I think we need to move deliberately with this.
Jacob, where can people submit public comments on this?
Yeah, so like I said before, public comment period is going to be open for 45 days, technically open today. But the main place to do it is just on the Little Cottonwood Canyon EIS website, which, let's see if I can remember this off the top of my head, should be littlecottonwoodcanyoneis.u.utah.gov.
That's, I had it in front of me here, just waiting. Little Cottonwood EIS.
Okay.
.utah.
So close.
No, excuse me, .u.utah.gov. Again, that's littlecottonwoodeis.u.utah.gov.
We'll tweet it out.
Yeah,
okay. We'll tweet it
great.
Out.
Great, yeah, thanks. Jacob Scholl, State Watch reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. I really appreciate your filling us in on this. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. We are going to take a quick break, and we will come back with, we'll duck into the world of sports for a little bit. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Jacob Scholl, reporter Courtney Tanner, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or by tweeting them to at KCPW. And actually, I held off announcing a new guest who is joining us right now, and only for a little while. That is Josh Newman, Utah athletics reporter with the Tribune. And thanks for being here, Josh, all the way from Gainesville, Florida.
Yes, good morning. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks for joining the show. We really appreciate it. And the reason that you were there in Florida is for the University of Utah football season opener. You you wrote, Josh, a kind of preview of the season that talks about the team and the road ahead and the expectations for the team. The Utes are ranked number 7 in the nation. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, but Joshua, this is the highest preseason ranking that they've ever had. Why do they have so high of a ranking?
Yeah, you know, this is their highest ever preseason ranking, and that has everything to do with, you know, they're returning 17 starters from a team that, you know, from a team that won the Pac-12 title last year, went to a Rose Bowl, right, played this epic Rose Bowl against Ohio State. And, you know, within that 17, you're returning, you know, the quarterback in Cameron Rising and the running back in Tavion Thomas. You have, you know, two very legitimate pass catching tight ends in Brand Keithy and Dalton Kincaid. And, you know, I can go up and down the roster. Right. It's just full of, you know, veteran guys who have played in huge games, played in a Rose Bowl, played in high leverage situations. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of expectations. I mean, I think where the program is right now, with the last 4 or 5 years having a lot of success, I think the reasonable, rational expectation at this point every year is to at least be contending to win the Pac-12.
Right.
But then in some cases where you have this veteran heavy team, you can probably start dreaming about getting to a college football playoff. So,
right.
Look, I've written ad nauseum. I've spoken about it ad nauseum. If, you know, this is the most important opener in the history of the program, just because if you win this game tomorrow night, everything is on the table. Like, no dream is too big if you win this game. If you start the season 1-0 with this win at Florida, you can get to a college football playoff.
Josh, can you just explain how the college football playoffs work? Like, you know, obviously they're you know, there are teams from the Pac-12 who don't get there despite having very winning records. And being great teams, and then there are teams from other, you know, divisions, other from elsewhere in the country that make it with less winning records than some Pac-12 members. Can you just explain how the playoffs work to us?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, just because there's like major wholesale changes coming to the way the playoff works,
right.
But I digress. The way it works now is the college football playoff is a four-team event, and there is a selection committee. I forget exactly how many members are on the committee. I think it's 8 or 10 members on the playoff selection committee, and they are, you know, sitting in a room once a week from like late October through December, and they are ranking what they believe to be the top 25 teams based on their ranking criteria. The top four teams at the end of the season go on to this, again, this four-team event, and it's those four teams that are playing for the national championship. You know, you take, you know, there's two bowl games that act as, you know, the playoff semifinals, and then there's the college football playoff national championship game like 10 days later. The big complaint, look, this has been going on since 2014. Okay, was the first year of the playoff. The big complaint has been, well, it's only four teams, and you know, four spots. There's only like, on an annual basis, there's only like six teams nationally that are like really contending for this thing every year, like Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State, you know, in some years, Oklahoma,
right.
A team like Notre Dame, if things go well. So it's only four teams. And it's been labeled something of a, you know, an invitational.
Yeah.
You know, the Pac-12 teams, you know, look, you have to have preferably no losses, or at worst, you have to have one loss to be in, you know, legitimate contention to get to this four team event. And, you know, the Pac-12, it's, you know, the Pac-12 gets weird. You know, there's always hiccups for all these teams. You know, you're traveling to these different, you know, remote outposts, right? Like Washington State, where the weather gets weird and, you know, good teams, you know, falter in some of these environments. And, you know, it seems like every year, you know, the Pac-12, you know, you let the dust settle and all these teams have two losses and or three losses, and there's just no viable Pac-12 candidate. But then, you know, people are looking at this Utah team
yeah.
as, you know, potentially maybe finishing unbeaten, maybe finishing with one loss. I think that's a very, you know, viable, feasible scenario that, you know, Utah finishes 12-1, and maybe we're sitting here in early December talking about Utah as like the number three seed or the number four seed. You know, based on the current criteria, this Utah team is probably fairly being viewed as a potential playoff crasher. Like, there's real optimism that this Utah team can do enough, even if they wind up with one loss, they can do enough to, you know, to break through finally. You know, a Pac-12 team hasn't been to this thing since 2016. And frankly, there hasn't been a Pac-12 team that's gotten even remotely close to getting there. But this Utah team, again, is kind of viewed as that potential.
Yeah. You wrote about the people who didn't leave the team to pursue NFL careers, even though they could have. That's part of, I think, one of the reasons there's a high expectation. A lot of hopes, as you said, riding on quarterback Cam Rising. And your story kind of starts with him, but through the words of another player, tight end Brant Keithy, who you mentioned, a sort of, you know, what could have been from last season had Cam Rising been the QB from the beginning, right?
Yeah, you know, I started that story off. I was obviously at the Rose Bowl last December covering Utah, you know, in the week leading up to the game. And, you know, the media access at something like that is very strict. Like, one day we would get like four offensive players, you know, the next day four defensive players. I think Kyle Whittingham only spoke, geez, I think he spoke twice all week. So, you know, I walked up to Brant Keithy during, you know, an offensive day and nobody else was around. And he starts, you know, really speaking his mind about how, you know, Rising lost a camp quarterback competition to Charlie Brewer during August. So, you know, Rising did not begin the season as the starter. And then Brewer did not work out. He was gone after three games, and Rising steps in, and just everything flipped. Everything. Everybody just had a different pep in their step, and Rising, you know, had control of the locker room, and, you know, the players trust him, and he went on this crazy run. You know, they win 9 of 10 games to get to the Rose Bowl, which, again, they lost. But, you know, talking to Keithy, he really felt that if Rising had started the season instead of Brewer, maybe things turned out differently. Of course, they, you know, look, you got to a Rose Bowl, right? This is a, you know, a mountaintop summit type of accomplishment for this Utah program, getting to a Rose Bowl. But the way Keithy saw it, they could have gotten to a college football playoff last year.
Wow.
Maybe they go undefeated with rising last year. I disagree with that, but that's the way Keithy saw it. And, you know, part of Keithy's decision to come back for one more year, he could have gone to the NFL, and Dalton Kincaid, the other tight end, could have gone to the NFL.
Yeah.
Tavion Thomas, the running back, could have gone to the NFL. But, you know, part of the decision-making process for all of these guys that came back was that Rising came back and a lot of their teammates were coming back. And they felt like there was unfinished business last year because, again, some of these guys, you know, besides Keithy, thought that they could have done more. So here we are.
Yeah.
Early September, all of these guys are back. There has never been this much hype around a Utah football program. And we're going to find out what's what, you know, tomorrow night.
Yeah.
If they can get this one tomorrow night, the season takes a very drastic, interesting turn moving forward.
You know, famous venue, as you said, a big deal for the first game, sold out, I believe.
Yep.
We don't have to go into the deep backstory here, but would you mind kind of giving us the kind of Cliff's Notes version of how this game actually came together? A Pac-12 team, an SEC team, opening game, kind of unusual, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wrote about this, if people want to check it out, over at sltrib.com. You know, scheduling in college football is weird. You know, these games are usually scheduled, you know, years in advance. Some non-conference games on Utah's docket are, you know, we're talking about like 2032. Like Utah has games scheduled way out there. So, you know, Mark Harlan, the athletic director at Utah, comes aboard in, June of 2018. And he pretty immediately sets out to like beef up the non-conference schedule. You know, in most years, Utah is pretty happy to play, you know, whatever, like a Weber State or a Southern Utah, maybe one other opponent of like a bit of a higher caliber. But Utah is generally not playing Florida or SEC schools or Big Ten schools. They do in some years, but it's not the norm. So, you know, Harlan comes in, wants to beef up the schedule. You know, he signs on deals, you know, home and home agreements with Baylor, Wisconsin, LSU. And then, you know, in the middle of him trying to beef up the schedule in future years, his old friend, Scott Strickland, the AD at the University of Florida, Scott Strickland is trying to, you know, line up a home and home agreement with a different Pac-12 school, not Utah. He was talking to somebody else, but there were hiccups and they couldn't get to the finish line. So Strickland starts talking to Harlan. You know, Mark Harlan used to be the AD at South Florida. So Strickland and Harlan are old friends, and, you know, they're talking about open dates and what might work. And it just came together, you know? So in September of 19, you know, they jointly announced this home and home agreement between Florida and Utah. The fascinating part about this to me is, again, these games are scheduled years in advance, right? Years, even a decade. At the time, Florida was in a tremendous spot, right? They had a very capable young head coach in Dan Mullen. They had just been to the Peach Bowl in 2018. They wind up going to the Sugar Bowl in 2019. And the trajectory of Florida is like way up. Whereas Utah was, you know, this budding power in the Pac-12. They hadn't broken through to win the Pac-12, but they were, you know, they were trending positively. But now, you know, 3 years after this game gets announced, Dan Mullen is no longer the head coach of Florida. It's a first year head coach in Billy Napier. There's a lot of question marks around Florida. Whereas Utah, again, 3 years later, Utah has broken through, you know, wins the Pac-12, gets to a Rose Bowl. You've got all these guys back, ranked number 7 in the country. So I'm always fascinated by, you know, the nature of college football scheduling, where when you announce a game, everything looks one way, but now years later, we're ready to play this game, and things look a completely different way right now for both teams.
Yeah, safe to say, I think that Florida, I guess you reap what you sow, but, you know, wouldn't have wanted to start their season against the number 7 ranked team in the country. I want to bring in, I know we got to let you go here in a second, Josh, so I want to bring in Robert Gierke, who's news columnist with the Tribune. And Gierke, I'll just ask you, do you pay attention to the ins and outs of Utah football? We're kind of adding to the hype here. The season looks like it's going to be one to watch.
I do. I'm a Utah alumnus, and I just, it makes me nervous to see him ranked so high, because it's really easy to fall from up that high. You know, it's exciting. It's exciting to see. I'm going to be watching closely tomorrow night, and I'm a little concerned about Utah's secondary. They got exposed in the Rose Bowl against Ohio State. There were injuries, a lot of injuries, but, you know, I think that's the big question mark for me, especially when you lose a guy like Devin Lloyd from last year's team. So it's exciting. It's a little trepidatious, I guess, and I'm looking forward to seeing this game tomorrow.
Josh, I'll ask you just before we do let you go, what we should be paying attention to as fans, you know, in this game or all season, however you want to interpret that. Like, what's the sort of, is there something you would have us specifically pay attention to tomorrow night, for example, at the game?
Yeah, I think that Gerke touched on it. You know, the linebacker position for Utah is definitely in question. It's a group in transition, right, with Devin Lloyd going to the NFL and Nephi Sewell, the other very fine linebacker, also going to the NFL. So that's been a real topic of conversation here for the for the last 9 months. You know, quite frankly, you know, like, what do you do there? So, you know, coincidentally, the projected, you know, the new projected starting linebacker for Utah, Mo Diabate, is a transfer from the University of Florida. So his first game as a Ute, he's going, you know, home, so to speak, to play in the Swamp. Who else? You know, Kareni Reed, another young kid, a second year guy, you know, played well in short stretches last year when Devin Lloyd was hurt or Devin Lloyd was out for the first half after a targeting penalty in one game. So it's Diabate, it's Kareni Reed. And then the third linebacker is Lander Barton, who, you know, a lot of locals should know that name. Brighton High School graduate, Brighton High School star, four-star recruit. Look, 18-year-old kid, very capable, has never played a down of college football. And you are now asking Lander Barton to not – look, we're not starting our season against, you know, Weber State or Southern Utah. We're starting it, like, in the Swamp, in SEC country with the heat, the humidity, the environment. So, personally – I'm very intrigued by what Utah can get out of Lander Barton tomorrow night in what will obviously be his first college game.
Well, Josh Newman, you wrote a great profile as well of Clark Phillips III, the cornerback that is worth checking out. I'll encourage people to go check that out at sltrib.com. I know, though, that we need to let you go, and so I will just say with that, Josh Newman, who dipped into our Zoom all the way from Gainesville, Florida, thanks for making time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, folks. Appreciate it.
Yep. Have a good day. And a reminder to listeners that you are tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. You know, since we're just in the world of sports, why don't we get another big piece of sports news out of the way? Utah Jazz star guard Donovan Mitchell being traded to the Cleveland Cavaliers. It's news that is just a day old, but already feels pretty picked over. Here's my understanding of it. Cleveland is sending guard Colin Sexton, forward Lauri Markkanen, and rookie guard Ochai Agbaji, along with three unprotected first-round picks to the Utah Jazz. So there's that. We don't have Eric Walden here, who wrote the story on this. I'm just going to turn to Robert Gerke, who is a news columnist, and I know you're a Jazz fan, so I'm going to rely on you. Your thoughts on this? It's sports, trades happen, but to me, this is a tough one because of the fact that, you know, it's as tough as losing Rudy Gobert. Donovan Mitchell was kind of the soul of the team that we followed for a number of years.
Yeah, somewhere Andy Larson is having fits because whenever Gerke talks about the Jazz, it's never, no good comes of it. But yeah, I mean, this was a huge trade. I think everybody had been speculating it was going to happen for a long time because the team was sort of dismantling the team. And what they got with this trade is a gamble for the future. All of these picks over the next several years, on top of the picks that they would normally have anyway, tells you that this is not a team that's looking to win next season or the season after that, but we're looking, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years down the road. It's, you know, a lot of people are excited about the prospect of having all of these picks, you know, in the future. You can deal those pretty easily and try to really rebuild this team. I personally think that what is sad about losing Donovan is because he was such an integral part of this community. Over the time he was here, he was sort of a conscience, a voice of reason for this community. Called people on their stuff, you know. And yeah. I think that was an important role for him, and he was beloved. And you know, I don't think it was likely that he was going to stick around. So you know, Cleveland's gain is our loss in some ways. And hopefully, you know, for the Jazz, you know, hopefully they can use this to, you know, build a franchise in the future, or build a winning, competing, you know, top tier franchise in the future.
And I guess that's the plan. But yeah, you said sort of soul of the team, soul of the community, spoke his mind on behavior that he saw as problematic from politicians, et cetera, addressing racism, or just being a good member of the community. I think he made this place better. I'm also sad to see him go. And but
yeah,
but that's this is
yeah. I mean, and wish and I don't think there's any ill will or hard feelings toward Donovan at all. I think everybody loves and supports him and wants to see him do well and wants what's best for him. And it just wasn't going to work out here. And I think and I don't think the Jazz are done wheeling and dealing either. We've got Bogdanovich, Bojan Bogdanovich, and Mike Conley. That it's hard to see how they fit into this team over the next few years. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's more moves to come.
Sure. Sometimes I take it kind of seriously, and ultimately it's still, of course, millionaires playing basketball. I gotta check my perspective sometimes. But with that, let's actually head to another break in the show. That was news columnist Robert Gierke helping me talk about the Donovan Mitchell news. We'll take another quick break and return with the latest in a story about racist taunting at a BYU volleyball game. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stick around.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Courtney Tanner, Jacob Scholl, and Robert Gierke. This is our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK or by tweeting them to @KCPW. And Courtney Tanner, we'll bring you into the conversation finally. A week ago, there was an incident that happened at a Brigham Young University volleyball game, a game against Duke. And, maybe I'll just ask you to tell us what happened at this game, just to start with. We'll hear those details and then move forward. But, yeah, what happened at this volleyball game between Duke and BYU at Brigham Young University?
So most probably know this. I'll keep the summary kind of short. It's drawn, obviously, national attention. Yeah. But Duke sophomore Rachel Richardson, who is the lone Black starter on her team, has said when she was serving, she kind of distinctly heard fans of BYU yelling racial slurs at her during the match. And she, flagged down her coaches and said, let's take care of this. BYU said that they had kind of stepped in. They put a police officer out there to kind of patrol the BYU student section to listen for other slurs. And that's kind of where we're at.
I know that part of what Richardson, the Duke player, said she was frustrated by, you mentioned the fact that they put out that Brigham Young University put a police officer out there, but she said that she was frustrated by the fact that there wasn't more immediate action, meaning during the match. Can you kind of talk about that, and then I'll get to the latest?
Yeah, and it depends kind of who you ask. So yeah, Richardson has since said, she's frustrated that more wasn't done to, remove the fan. But BYU says that at that time during the match, there wasn't a specific fan pointed out to them to remove.
The school did take action afterwards. In fact, they banned a specific fan, a person who had been identified as the one yelling this offensive and racist term. And actually, there's more to that as well. The specific fan was also singled out as somebody who was identified by this player as kind of making some sort of threatening statement. Can you talk about that whole part of this?
Yeah, and it's complicated because there are multiple perspectives here. But yeah, so BYU stepped in. Duke had pointed out a fan to them that they said approached a volleyball player after the event. We don't know if that's Richardson or not based on the police report. But essentially, they pointed out this fan that had approached a Duke player after the event, kind of got in her face, according to the police report from BYU police. And then Duke also said that was the person that was yelling the slurs. So BYU took action, banned this fan. But according to the police report, they later looked at surveillance footage, game footage, and determined that while this fan had approached a Duke volleyball player after the match, the fan that they had banned doesn't appear to have been the one yelling the slurs.
And they can't tell, I guess, from the video, where a fan may have been yelling these slurs from. I mean, they're actually appealing to the public, right, for kind of help on this?
Right. So we asked them about that. They reviewed this footage and were able to rule this person out for having not yelled slurs. We asked, well, have you looked at the footage and seen who was? And they said that they haven't been able to determine that yet. BYU is still kind of investigating this event. They pulled in, you know, athletics, their communication department, the police, you know, looking through these videos. Police have said that no one has stepped forward from the student section to say, you know, I was standing next to this person who yelled the slurs. So they haven't got any tips there, but they are asking people to come forward.
And meanwhile, there's been kind of a campus-wide conversation about, you know, about being better, about not, well, obviously about trying to address racism and racist comments being used. Can you talk about how the school has been addressing that, or I guess trying to confront that?
Right. So the athletic director at BYU at the volleyball game the next day talked about, you know, that fans need to do better, that they need to welcome an opposing team and you know, abide by BYU's kind of faith, you know, overall, that it's to be kind to others and to treat others with respect. So the school has kind of stepped in to kind of put out those reminders. Kevin, our BYU sports writer, went to the volleyball game, I think it was yesterday, and just talked about kind of the different atmosphere there, how there were, you know, more police there, and you know, just kind of a change and the volleyball players were wearing shirts that said love everyone. So I think that the school is trying to take this seriously and address maybe if there's a cultural issue here. But there's a lot of debate in the community. So,
and I guess one final piece of this that maybe, well, I do have a question about sort of what you're waiting to find out or what comes next in the story, but people from Brigham Young University were specifically reaching out directly to this volleyball player, right? And trying to make amends and say, this isn't who we are kind of thing.
Some folks were. Rachel Richardson has said that, you know, the BYU volleyball player specifically have talked to her and apologized for the atmosphere. And, you know, a lot of the folks on BYU's athletics have reached out to her. She sat down with folks. So, yeah, there's definitely people coming forward to apologize.
Thanks for that, Courtney. And I guess maybe I will ask what you're waiting for on you probably want to see whether or not they're able to determine where the shouting was coming from. Is that what you're waiting for on this story?
Yeah, I think that's definitely kind of the next step. You know, it'll be interesting to see kind of what is determined in the investigation. And, you know, I do think that this has become kind of a wider issue on BYU, you know, trying to determine, you know, folks are having this conversation. Is this really who we are? Or are we better than this? But, you know, it's worth pointing out that they put out a report, I think a year ago. I reported on it then. I can't even remember when it was. But, you know, a report on how students of color feel at the school. And, you know, they don't feel safe. So I definitely think there's been a reckoning over this incident.
Courtney Tanner, thank you for that. Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Tribune. I mean, this is a story that brought a lot of national attention. It's kind of an evolving story, as of yet unknown, the totality of it. But yeah, comments?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's an embarrassment for BYU. It's a black eye for the school and for the LDS Church, frankly, because every one of these national stories talk about how the church is owned by how the school is owned by the LDS Church. I think these questions, notwithstanding, about who said what at what time and who, you know, it's sort of secondary at this point. I think, as Courtney noted, it's important that there's a discussion going on, not just at BYU, but a discussion going on, I think, more generally in this state. We've seen incidents like this transpire, whether it's at the Davis County School District in Izzy Teicher or any number of incidents in any other number of schools around the state, in workplaces. So I think it plays into part of the larger discussion that we need to be having about the topics of race, the topics of what we're willing to tolerate and when we're willing to step in and say, no, that's not acceptable. And you know, where we go from here, what we teach our children in schools to try to, you know, educate them and inform them about, you know, how we approach race in our society. So hopefully there's, maybe I'm a little Pollyannish, but hopefully that this sort of stimulates that discussion, because we can't obviously undo what was done. And who did it is sort of a secondary issue at this point. Hopefully we can look to move this discussion forward a little bit.
All right. Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Courtney Tanner, I want to actually, just for a brief moment here, because we have a few more minutes before we head to our underplayed stories of the week, turn to some other reporting you did. You wrote about allegations against a Bingham High School wrestling coach. And I'm wondering if you could just kind of bring us up to speed on what happened there. This is somebody who's no longer a coach at the team, but who is charged with sexually abusing a minor. Can you tell us about that?
Right. And you kind of captured it there. A wrestling coach that was working at Bingham High School was charged yesterday with sexually abusing a minor, as well as some counts for sending nude photos of himself to this same individual. At the time, it was a 17-year-old female student at the school. All the charges are felonies. I guess that's worth pointing out. And the school district, Jordan School District, said he's no longer an employee there.
I guess that is. Thank you for bringing us up to speed on that. I mean, it's a tough story to report on, but appreciate, as always, your bringing us the information that we need to know. With that, I think we might as well turn now to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. We got a little bit of time to play with here, though. Robert Gerke, do you got a pick for underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, I think I want to encourage people to take a look at a piece that Eric Peterson with the Utah Investigative Journalism Project did in conjunction with the Salt Lake Tribune. You can check it out at sltrib.com. The piece focuses on a young woman from Utah County who said she was raped, got a rape kit, reported it to police. The prosecutor said, we're not going to pursue this. She took it upon herself then to sort of investigate her own crime or the crime perpetrated against her. And so it's just it's an interesting tale. It's also a jumping off point about why prosecutors end up declining to prosecute in a lot of circumstances. And it's an ongoing, again, another one of these tough discussions that we're having and need to have. So check that out at sltrib.com.
Worth checking out. Eric Peterson's piece, he's with the Utah Investigative Journalism Project. You can find it at sltrib.com. Jacob, we'll go to you for your pick for underplayed story of the week, if you're ready.
I wouldn't exactly call it underplayed,
sure.
But at the same time, you know, I don't think you can amplify this enough. Just want to point out the Salt Lake Tribune's coverage of Lake Powell just recently put out, you know, a lot of very, very good reporting on that situation. And all of that reporting can be found at sltrib.com/Powell.
sltrib.com/Powell. Robert, you wrote a little bit on this, on that piece, right?
I mean, I had a piece in there, but it was just terrific work by Zach Podmore, Brian Maffley, great photos by Rick Egan, good work by Bethany Baker putting some videos together if you're checking it out on the website, and Grant Burningham for sort of shepherding the whole project. It was really well done.
Can I ask you, I mean, the sort of gist of the story, not the gist, but part of what's described in the story is the death of Lake Powell and the possibility that it not remain a reservoir and become something else.
Yeah, we're getting very close to the point where we can't produce power from it. There's not enough water in the Colorado River to provide what has been promised to the lower basin and still sustain the upper basin uses, upper basin being those sort of northern states, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah. And you know, Zach focuses on the repercussions if this continues and we lose the power production. It also focuses on sort of the return of Glen Canyon. And that's sort of what my piece focused on, is that, in my opinion, Lake Powell's doomed. We're on a trajectory that, unless it changes, we're going to lose Lake Powell entirely. So we need to start planning now for what that looks like. We need to start replacing the power. We need to start assuring that upper basin states get their fair share of water. We need to start helping those communities like Page and Bullfrog convert from water-based recreational economies to more sort of national park Moab type economies. So there's a lot to be done, or we can just pretend it's not going to happen and then reap the whirlwind.
Well, one aspect of it that seems sort of fascinating is the idea of this planned development project, the Lake Powell pipeline, that would move water out of Lake Powell, I guess more water out of Lake Powell since it's drying up.
And that's what Brian Maffley's story is about, is sort of how this whole project has been a little bit murky from the get-go and is very much called into question now given this scarcity of water in Lake Powell. You know, you're not going to stick another straw in and start slurping water out if it's not there.
Yeah. Thanks for talking that out with me, Robert. You can check out that coverage again at sltrib.com/Powell. And Courtney Tanner, we will come to you now for your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'll highlight a story from Mark Eddington, who's our Southern Utah writer. He did an interesting story that published this morning about plans for a new hot spring resort in Southern Utah in Laverkan.
Wow. Okay. I had not seen it. That's underplayed for me. I'll check it out. SLTrib.com. I got a story by Blake Apgar from the Tribune, who just covered the fact that the Utah Transit Authority announced this week that it's offering free fares. It was yesterday and actually also today on all of its bus and rail services. That includes Front Runner, Park City, Salt Lake City Connector Bus, paratransit services, UTA On Demand, etc. And as well as Green Bike, the bike share program is doing this as well, offering free fares. And the idea here is to help with air quality. People think of air quality issues being a wintertime phenomenon, but we also have ozone issues in the summer. And Robert Grieke, I saw you came down on your bike today. So.
Yeah, I'm still gasping. It's a little murky out there.
All right. Well, with that, I will. Our show will wrap up, and I will just say thanks to the guests, Courtney Tanner, Jacob Scholl, and Robert Grieke, all with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, go Utah. Yeah, go Utes, yeah. All right, well, that does it for Behind the Headlines, which is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs over at kcpw.org. And feel free to make a pledge of support there as well. The station is a nonprofit, independent public media outlet, and we rely on your support to bring you programs like this one. Again, kcpw.org. And all of the coverage that we have been talking about can be found at sltrib.com. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week.